This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
A new federal watchdog report says Clearview AI's facial recognition technology violated federal and provincial laws on personal information. The Federal Privacy Commissioner said today the company's extracting of billions of images of people online is a clear violation of privacy rights because it represents mass surveillance. Clearview's AI technology allowed law enforcement and other clients the ability to match pictures against the company's data bank of more than 3 billion images. Clearview AI stopped offering its facial recognition services in Canada in response to the investigation last year.
It's been back to the future in Canadian privacy for the past couple of weeks. The return of lawful access, buried in Bill C-2, a border bill. The return of trying to exempt political parties from many privacy safeguards, buried in Bill C-4, an affordability measures bill. And the return of Clearview AI, with an Alberta court decision that has big implications not only for that company, but for the intersection between privacy and generative AI. This podcast will address the legislative proposals in the coming weeks. But for this week, we're going to unpack the Alberta Clearview AI decision. There's no one better to do that than my colleague, Professor Teresa Scazza, the Canada Research Chair in Information Law at the University of Ottawa. Professor Scazza is one of Canada's leading authorities on Canadian privacy, and she joins me on the podcast to discuss the case and what it means for generative AI and privacy reform more broadly. Teresa, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me back.
Okay, thanks. Thanks so much for joining. I think you're a three-time guest and definitely one of the very best when it comes to privacy. You know, Clearview AI seems to be kind of that case that just keeps on giving. We've now had multiple findings and rulings from a Canadian perspective, but there's a recent Alberta decision that has real significant implications that extend beyond even just core privacy to some of the moment's hottest issues, notably some of the privacy implications of using publicly available data by AI companies for generative AI purposes. To get us started, can you provide listeners with a bit of a refresher on Clearview AI, the incident that sparked so many of these kinds of cases, and how the Alberta decision fits into the equation, particularly, I guess, from a Canadian perspective?
Yeah, so back in 2020, the New York Times journalist Kashmir Hill broke a story about a US-based company that was scraping photographs from the public internet in order to create a massive facial recognition database. And that company was Clearview AI. And the access to this database was being marketed to police services around the world, including in Canada. And so that story obviously attracted a lot of international attention. And there were multiple investigations by privacy and data protection commissioners around the world, notably in Europe, Australia, New Zealand. For example, there were rulings against Clearview AI. And in Canada, the federal commissioner and the commissioners of Quebec, Alberta, and BC launched a joint investigation, which eventually led to a report of findings that concluded that although the data protection laws in those jurisdictions had exceptions to the requirement for consent for publicly available information, in other words, if information was publicly available, you didn't need individual consent to collect or use it, the exception didn't apply to information on the internet. And examples of where the exception might apply would be in books or magazines and digital equivalents, but not social media platforms. And the commissioners also found that even if there had been consent, the collection, use, and disclosure of the information wasn't for purposes that a reasonable person would consider appropriate in the circumstances. In other words, if you post pictures of your kid's birthday party online, you wouldn't consider it appropriate that the photographs would be used to create biometric face prints of the children to be used in a commercial facial recognition technology database.
We'll come back, of course, to the publicly available information exception in a moment. But before we get to that, the sort of the substantive related aspects of this case, Clearview tries for what it seems like most foreign companies try for right out of the gate, which is to sort of say, hey, there's a jurisdictional question here. You know, what What role does Canada or do Canadian commissioners have, whether federal or provincial, to be able to assert jurisdiction over this case? So they make that argument. How does the court respond on the jurisdictional question of whether or not Alberta can get into the Clearview AI issue?
Yeah, that's right. So Clearview said, look, we're a US-based company. We don't have offices in Canada. After the joint investigation, we stopped doing business in Canada. We no longer offer our services to Canadian police forces. And when we scrape the internet, when we scrape these social media sites are mostly big American companies, and we're scraping, and they have servers in the US. And so our activities are located in the US as well. So there's just no Canadian jurisdiction. But as you know, the Canadian courts use the real and substantial connection test to determine whether there is, whether Canadian laws apply in particular circumstances. And so they're looking for this real and substantial connection between the Canadian jurisdiction, which in this case is Alberta, and the activities of the respondent or the defendant. And so here the court found that although the Clearview argued that the data was stored on servers in the US, there wasn't actually any evidence that the social media platforms had all of their servers located in the US. There might have been some located in Canada. We didn't know for a fact. And in any event, there was evidence that they were scraping data from news media sites and other public websites. And therefore, they were in all likelihood scraping data based on servers in Canada. The information at issue was the personal information of individuals resident in Alberta, which was another connection. And the services had been offered to and used by police in Alberta. The fact that the company had chosen on its own to suspend, and it referred to it as a suspension, not a, you know, future, and we'll never do business here again. They suspended it. Doesn't mean that they're not going to start offering those services again. And at the time the complaint was filed, they were offering those services in Canada. So the court found that there was definitely a real and substantial connection to the Canadian jurisdiction that would ground the court's jurisdiction.
Okay, sure. And I mean, when you put it that way, users in Canada, capturing data in Canada, marketing services in Canada, it's hard to see how anyone would have thought otherwise, that they might be successful on the jurisdictional grounds.
Yeah.
But the focal point, as you suggested off the top, was this publicly available information exception. You started to explain a little bit the contours of it. Can you highlight a little bit once again, I suppose, what it involves, and even more, are there differences between what we see at the federal level when it comes to this exception and some of the provincial statutes that have provided for private sector privacy protections?
Yeah. So the Canadian model is really a consent-based model, and which as a sort of basic rule requires individuals to consent to any collection, use, or disclosure of their personal information. But the law is full of exceptions to the requirement of consent, and one of these is for publicly available information. And so it sounds like that's a potentially enormous exception, but it's been carefully tailored. And so typically the Canadian, BC, and Alberta laws define what is publicly available in their regulations. And those three definitions are similar. There's some differences between them, but they're basically similar. And they identify different categories of publicly available information. And the one that's relevant here is where personal information is contained in a publication. And the Alberta language says, including but not limited to a magazine, book, or newspaper, whether in print or electronic form, and then has some other conditions. It has to be available to the public, and it has to be reasonable to assume that the information is about provided that information. And if those conditions are met, then it's considered publicly available information. And the federal law and the BC law are similar in wording. There are a few differences that. Again, they have some, ultimately in the decision and in its consequences, they may have some meaning or significance, but that's basically the structure of the exception.
So they provide an illustrative list in terms of what would be covered by this, by using that word including. I'm getting flashbacks to fair dealing debates around copyright in Canada. What does Clearview AI argue with respect to the application of the exception in terms of some of their behavior, and what does the court think of that argument?
Yeah, so the first, Clearview made two main arguments, and the first one was that the commissioner's interpretation of the exception as not applying to content posted on social media platforms was unreasonable. They just said, Yeah, and it's a judicial review application. So the issue is not because a deference is owed to the commissioners. The issue is not whether they were right or wrong, but whether their decision was reasonable. And so Clearview was arguing that they made an unreasonable decision. The court found that the decision was reasonable. The commissioners had found that social media platforms were quite distinct from the conventional media that are discussed in the exception, like books, magazines, and newspapers. They're very different. They're not intermediated. People just post their own information online, for example. And the commissioners also, in their reasons, found that the privacy law protects rights. In fact, it's been described by the courts as quasi-constitutional in nature, and that in statutory interpretation, you tend to interpret rights broadly and exceptions to those rights narrowly. And so it was appropriate to give a more narrow or restrictive interpretation in this particular case. And the court said that that's reasonable. It's a reasonable interpretation. Clearview also made an alternative argument that if the court found the interpretation to be reasonable, then limiting the exception through that interpretation to conventional publications violated their freedom of expression under their charter. And so the argument there is that the freedom of expression includes not just simple expressive activity, but it also includes the activity of gathering the information you need in order to express yourself. And the court agreed with that argument, finding that the words in the Alberta regulations, particularly including but not limited to magazine, books, and newspapers, were what allowed the commissioner to interpret it to limit the exception to publications that were equivalent to those types of publications. And that would not include social media platforms, and that would then limit Clearview AI's freedom of expression. And so the constitutional remedy provided by the court was to remove those particular words, including but not limited to magazines, books, and newspapers, from the definition, saying that just left publications, which were something that had been intentionally made public.
Okay. I mean, so, and it's that this latter argument around the constitutionality of the provisions and its implication for freedom of expression that makes this case so interesting. I mean, I don't think we'd be discussing it, but for the addition of this constitutional dimension. You've written an excellent piece on this decision that I'll link to in the show notes, where you note that notwithstanding this constitutional finding, the court's still able to rule against Clearview AI. So can we explain precisely why that is before we sort of, I guess, come back to the implications of this constitutional ruling, which really may have an impact well beyond just the narrow confines of this case?
Yeah, and so Justice Feasby in the Alberta court referred to this as the belt and suspenders approach in the legislation, the idea that if you think of privacy as a pair of pants, it's kept up not just by a belt, but also by suspenders. So you had, let's say the publicly available information exception is the suspenders. If you take that away, you still have a belt to hold up your pants. And the belt in this case is the reasonable, the purposes that a reasonable person would consider appropriate in the circumstances. And I think this is a really important part of his decision. The fact that it's not, that everything is not won or lost on the publicly available information issue, that you can still look at what's being done with the personal information that's being harvested from the internet. And if it's not something that a reasonable person would consider appropriate in the circumstances, then it doesn't pass the test under the legislation and it can't be collected, used, or disclosed. And so in this case, that goes to this finding that people who post pictures, photographs of happy events, weddings, family get-togethers, parties, whatever it might be, are not expecting that a company is going to come along, harvest those pictures, create biometric face prints, and put them in a database that gets marketed to law enforcement.
Yeah, no, and I think that's right. And I think in some ways that's precisely why this case attracted as much attention as it did, as it was just so inconsistent with people's expectations about what would happen with some of the information they were posting. And so it's interesting to see that play out. Now, Clearview's loss at the end of the day may still be generative AI's gain, so to speak, because we've got this constitutional aspect of this decision. Why do you think the case sort of attracted some immediate attention from certainly some people in the legal community as being important from a generative AI perspective?
Yeah. So as you know, There is this ongoing investigation by the four commissioners, the same four commissioners that were involved in the Clearview AI case, into the practices of OpenAI. So there was a complaint about OpenAI. And one of the issues that will be considered in that investigation is the legality of OpenAI harvesting information from the public internet to train its generative AI system, ChatGPT. And so obviously the scope of the publicly available information exception is really a live issue for the OpenAI investigation. Now, in the Alberta case, I thought it was quite interesting that in explaining the constitutional issues, Justice Feasby talked about how it compared the activities of Clearview AI to search engines, saying that search engines, in order to produce their results, would go out and search the internet and bring back and produce results, and particularly in image databases, they might produce images and so on. And so that was an example of a use of data scraping on the internet, of the public internet, that actually was beneficial, that people appreciated and used, and the internet wouldn't function without search engines. And therefore, if you just say the publicly available information exception is constitutional, then you raise a real issue for search engines. And, you know, I read that and I think, sure, that's fine. But the real example is generative AI. And of course, I'm fairly certain that the court specifically chose not to talk about it, knowing that there was this open investigation. In fact, as you know, we've been waiting for quite some time for a report of findings from that investigation. And I suspect that the commissioners were also holding back on releasing their report of findings until this decision was released, knowing that the charter arguments had been made in this particular case. So now the commissioners are going to have to sit back and look at this decision and try to figure out what it means for their joint decision in the OpenAI case. Will be really interesting because, of course, the Alberta decision only addresses Alberta's legislation. It doesn't address BC or BC's legislation or the federal or Quebec laws.
Well, I mean, that creates an additional complication that's really interesting once you start getting, you know, different jurisdictions, even within Canada, with slight differences that really highlights how some of this may play out in different ways. You know, speaking of different jurisdictions, you know, we've now got this ruling in Alberta. You've just highlighted some of the potential implications more broadly in Canada, noting some of the potential differences that exist between the statutes. How does this compare with other jurisdictions, notably, of course, the EU, which is the driver of so much when it comes certainly to privacy and to a lesser extent, but still a notable extent on AI regulation as well?
Yeah, and that's where it gets interesting also in thinking about the failed privacy reform process that we had in Canada recently. So the EU's General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, contains a basis for processing data that doesn't require consent called legitimate interests. And for this exception to apply, the interests have to be legitimate and they have to not be overridden by the interests or fundamental rights and freedoms of the data subject, I'm quoting here, which require protection of personal data, in particular where the data subject is a child. So you can collect data without knowledge or consent, but you have to, or without consent, but you have to, there has to be a legitimate interest and you have to weigh it against the impacted rights and freedoms. So it's a contextual inquiry. And you need to take into account a range of factors. And so this has been a factor in the EU decisions against Clearview. And so it allows them to look at legitimate interests and those contextual factors instead of focusing on is it publicly available or not publicly available and making the decision on that basis. And so I think that's a significant difference. Now, the EU data commissioners that have considered this have all found that there has been a violation. And I'm sure that's in large part to do with the fact that Clearview is creating biometric data is highly sensitive in the EU and is specifically treated as such, and it's creating this biometric database that is being marketed to police services. So clearly it would have a significant impact on the individuals. So this is, you know, this is the way in which the European approach is different now. And as you know, Canada's Bill C-27, which died on the order paper with the federal election, did contain an exception for legitimate interests. A little bit different from the European approach because it's an exception to consent and not a separate freestanding basis, but it would have allowed for collection or use of information without knowledge or consent where the organization has a legitimate interest that outweighs any potential adverse effect on the individual resulting from that collection or use, and a reasonable person would expect the collection or use for such an activity. And so again, you get into this idea of what the reasonable person would expect. And so this Clearview AI example might not have passed the legitimate interest test under Bill C-27, but the activities of OpenAI might have, or of a Google search engine, or you know, some other company that is scraping data from the internet for purposes that have less of an impact on individuals and that fit within reasonable expectations. So it's interesting to see, you know, the different approach in the EU and how we had something that might have been better adapted to these circumstances in C-27, but we're now in a situation where we're waiting to see what's going to happen with privacy reform in Canada once again.
Yeah, no, of course. And while we wait for that, we have what some might see as anti-privacy with respect to lawful access. So not the top priority, at least not for the moment. Just out of curiosity, you know, there wasn't necessarily a deep study, or at least as much as I think many hoped for, around C-27, in part because there was, of course, the AI bill and then everything just got delayed. What would you say the response was like from some of the various stakeholders with respect to this particular reform? Thinking ahead to the prospect of bringing something back, is this something that the government is going to have heard that, you know, this is something that enjoys a fair amount of support? Or is this yet another one of those issues that if a government is concerned about sort of having to burn a lot of political capital on privacy, may decide some of this is more trouble than it's worth?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that there's enough, that bill has gone through, or the privacy part of that bill has gone through a lot of public consultation and debate and revision. And, you know, I think it reflects compromise. I think people on different sides of different issues are going to have you know, things that they wish were different. But overall, I think there's enough consensus to get the bill through, with perhaps one sticking point being the data protection tribunal, the new tribunal that's created, and whether it's actually necessary. And so, I think that's a, you know, that may be a more controversial issue. But overall, I think people just want it to get done.
Yeah. No, I think.
Because we could just talk about it for another 5 years or another 10 years. But I mean, you know, at a certain point, you need to, the legislation needs to adapt to changing circumstances. And I think this is an example of where a legitimate interest exception would be less artificial than the publicly available information exception in this context.
And I think that's a fair characterization. Certainly, I think of the amount of study that's taken place and sort of the hope, I think, amongst many that perhaps the AI bill that was included in C-27 gets sidelined, but that there's enough consensus around privacy that they could move forward. You know, why don't we wrap with this? Speaking of reforms, one of the other aspects in your piece that you note is that there's also work that's taking place around provincial reforms, including in Alberta, which may have been, in a sense, waiting for some of this to play out. And there's certainly a desire among some for greater harmonization in Canadian privacy rules. You know, some might say that PIPEDA and its rules around substantial similarity were supposed to avoid this. You know, I guess, how big of an issue is this becoming? And we see differences amongst provinces in a number of different areas in the digital space. We've seen it just in the last couple of weeks around the former Bill C-11 and Quebec's move to regulate streaming services. We see it in the news space. How much of this is emerging as well on the privacy side, and how big of a concern do you think this is becoming?
Yeah. So now we've started to talk about internal trade barriers in Canada, right? Privacy can be characterized as one of those internal trade barriers in the sense that if you're going to be marketing or selling products across the country, you have to think in terms of the four different private sector data protection laws that we have. So one in BC, one in Quebec, one in Alberta, and then at the federal level. And it can be challenging for organizations to think in terms of compliance with those four laws, particularly if there are differences between them. And as you know, Quebec went ahead and reformed its law ahead of of Canada and the other provinces, and there are now some significant differences between Quebec's laws and those in those other jurisdictions. And so that has become a bit of a challenge. The commissioners, the Canadian privacy commissioners, have the federal, provincial, and territorial commissioners have built terrific collaborative working arrangements to carry out joint investigations. And in this case, it's an example of the commissioners with private sector jurisdiction. And that has benefits for the effective use of resources by the commissioners. It has benefits for companies, which now face one joint investigation instead of four separate investigations. And it also has the added benefit of being able to provide some harmonized interpretations of applicable concepts across the different laws. So keeping the laws in line through interpretation, which can be really helpful. But what the Clearview AI case shows, I think, is the fragility of that harmonized approach, because even slight differences in wording, and here the Alberta judge, you know, notes and distinguishes the Alberta regulations because they have four or five words that are not found in the federal legislation or in the BC legislation. So even slight differences in wording can have big implications. Clearview's strategy in this case, when each of the provincial commissioners that has order-making powers made orders, its strategy was to seek judicial review of each of those, leaving the joint harmonized report of findings vulnerable to the possibility that a court in any one of those provinces might find the findings to be unreasonable, even if the others found it reasonable. Then what do you do with your harmonized approaches, right? So as soon as you've got judicial review applications going on in three different provinces, you never know what the outcome is going to be. And so here we have a different outcome in Alberta than in BC. BC, there's all, the judicial review in BC has already been decided. The constitutional arguments weren't made in the BC case. So the BC legislation is constitutional and the publicly available information exception is applied in that case. And so, you know, you start to see the potential for things breaking down. Bill C-27 would have modernized the federal law, and Alberta and BC have been patiently waiting for the federal government to get on with it before modernizing their own laws. But Alberta is in the process of reforming its public sector, health sector, and private sector data protection laws right now. And they've indicated that they understand the value of harmonization, but how long are they going to be prepared to wait on the private sector law reform if the federal government doesn't act? So there's potential for more fracturing along those lines. And again, as I said, even if they're relatively harmonized, there's the potential for slight differences in wording to take on significant implications in these joint investigations and their repercussions. And then another issue that's not raised in the Clearview AI case, but I think is interesting, is we're now starting to contemplate substantial new enforcement powers for commissioners, including the power to levy very significant administrative monetary penalties. And so one issue that I'm watching and I'm interested in is what happens when you've got Quebec reform that gives the commissioner in Quebec these administrative monetary penalty powers. If you have federal law, and Bill C-27 also contained these powers, and if the provinces, if BC and Alberta follow the, you know, if there's a Bill C-27 repeat and they follow that, you're going to have four jurisdictions investigating jointly these complaints, and each province has the power to impose huge administrative monetary penalties. And you can be sure that the companies are not going to want to face four separate administrative monetary penalties for the same breach that's being jointly investigated in Canada. And so it's not clear what's going to happen in those cases and what how that's going to impact or affect the approach. So, you know, there are some real challenges for the stronger data protection laws in Canada, for the next generation of data protection laws. And I think we need to be already thinking about, you know, how do we harmonize effectively so that we don't create these situations where, you know, the scheme becomes too complicated, too unworkable. You know, the goals are very, very similar across the board, and we need to have something that works effectively.
Okay, super interesting. You know, and I think the way you started your response to that question by talking about internal trade barriers being a moment when this is a significant focus. The piece you wrote on this decision is really excellent. And thank you so much both for writing that and for taking time out to come on the podcast and talk about it.
Well, thank you so much for your interest in it. We appreciate it.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at lawbitespod or follow Michael Geist at mgeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo Lebron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose Lebron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.